The topic today, there's kind of two questions I'll be tackling. And the first one especially is not a comfortable one. And we live in a culture that wants to shape everything based on how we want to live and what we want to have be true. And especially as followers of God, we've got to be very, very careful not to do that. So to read what God's word says and not adapt it to fit how we want to live, but adapt with God's help, adapt our lives to fit what this is outlining for us. So I'm going to be covering a lot, and I really want to encourage you to, if you've got the YouVersion Bible app, to open that up, and you have to have the latest version or this won't work in case you haven't used it. And if you open it up and you click on the bottom right, at least this is true for iPhone users, where it says more, and then you'll see something that says events. And if you've got location awareness turned on your phone, the top events will be Community of Hope, and that's what you want. When we post this message online, it will. I'm going to have the notes up there too, because I'm going to cover a whole lot of verses, and I'm not going to read all of them. By the way, Levi, is that recording? I want to make sure we can get, okay, awesome. So two questions, and this is a bunch to cover. I'm probably going to go a little bit long, and I'm going to try not to talk too fast and try to cover too much, because we could really spend a couple of weeks on both of these topics. So, and you'll see how they're tied together. The first question is, what about that person out there who, they're a good person, maybe they follow some other faith or religion, and they're a moral person, they're kind, but they've never heard about Jesus. Would God really send that person to hell? And really, the rest of that thought, as we're chewing on it, is, would God send that person to hell? Because that doesn't really seem fair to us, right? Does anybody agree with me? Has anybody had that thought run through their minds? I'm seeing heads being nodded, right? So what does God's word have to say about this? And again, I've got to resist the urge to spend too much time on this, because we can say a whole lot about it. The Bible doesn't very specifically address that exact question, but here's what the Bible does have to say. First of all, there really is a hell. And Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
there really is a hell. And this is not something we like to talk about. Most of the teachings about hell in the Bible come directly from the mouth of Jesus. Jesus spoke about it actually quite a lot. So this is not something we can sidestep and go, it really doesn't matter. That's just something that other people added later. No, Jesus kind of talked about it a lot. And hell is the place of justice and God's wrath. And God's wrath is not something we like to talk about. And I think one of the main reasons we don't like hearing about wrath is because the human experience of wrath is very broken. When we are feeling wrathful about something, most of the time it's coming from a place of selfishness or impatience or pride, lots of other broken places. I don't know if any human other than Jesus has ever experienced wrath that was pure and unmixed with something broken. And so we don't think about wrath as something good, but God's wrath rises up out of his goodness. God is wrathful when his goodness is violated. And God is wrathful when someone that he loves is harmed or hurt. And he has a right to be. And I guarantee you there's nobody in here that hasn't hurt somebody else or in some way violated the goodness of God and said, God, I don't need you. I can be my own God. In some way or another, we've all done that. And God is right to be wrathful. And so hell is the place where justice is carried out because God is also a God of justice. And we like justice when it's operating on our behalf, right? When you have been wronged, don't you want there to be payment of some sort? Now, sometimes, again, because we're broken, we're wanting a payment that's not actually equal to the crime. But when you've wronged God, you've wronged an eternal, infinite God. And so the payment is eternal and infinite. So Jesus says, and I'll just cover a few of these verses, don't fear the one who can kill the body. Don't fear those who can kill the body but are not able to kill the soul. Rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. This is Jesus speaking. So it will be at the end of the age, the angels will go out, separate the evil people from the righteous and throw them into the blazing furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And he says a lot of other things about hell. Hell is where God's justice is carried out. But the amazing thing that we need to remember is that God has offered a way for us not to have to pay that price. And he's offered it by paying himself, which is pretty amazing. Now, if God continues to offer somebody that payment, and they continue to go, no thanks, God, I got this, then they have to make that payment. And does that seem fair? I mean, it seems fair that God has offered payment to be made. But this is why it's really, really important for us to be telling people about Jesus, about the one who has paid the price on their behalf. And Paul talks about this in Romans 10. There's some really interesting things that are going on here in Romans 10. Paul says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But then he says, how then can they call on him if they have not believed in him? And how can they believe in him without hearing about him? And how can they hear unless somebody goes and tells them? Do you hear what he's saying there? He's saying it's really important for us to go and tell people about Jesus so that they can hear about him, so that they can call upon him, so that they can be saved. So getting back to that question, what about that person who hasn't heard about Jesus? We need to go and tell them. Paul is saying it's really important that they find out so that they can call on him, so that they can be saved. But then Paul goes on to say, but the fact is, they have heard about him. And then he quotes Psalms 19. Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. It says, day after day they pour forth speech, and night after night they display knowledge. And then it says, there's no language or tongue where their voice has not been heard. And Paul is saying here, and he says elsewhere, creation is telling people, if they're looking, that there's a God. And not just that there is a God, but what he's even like. So Paul is saying, in another sense, they have heard. So if they're rejecting, they're knowingly rejecting God. And then he quotes this really interesting verse in Isaiah. Here it is. This is Isaiah 65 that he's quoting. Paul says, Isaiah says boldly, I was found by those who were not looking for me. I revealed myself to those who were not asking for me. So what he's saying there is that, yes, God can work in the hearts of people in mysterious ways and draw them to himself, maybe through creation, maybe just through the Holy Spirit working in their heart. And God can save people if he wants to, however he wants to. But we are still not absolved of our responsibility to go and tell people about Jesus. But here's the final thing that I want to say in regards to this question about hell. We can take comfort from the fact that God will always do what is right and what is good and what is fair. And if it seems to us in this life that God might be doing something that's unfair, remember that your judgment, my judgment, is broken. How many times have one of you thought that something was going to be an awesome idea? It just seemed like the right thing, and then it turned out to be a disaster. Am I alone in this?
Yes. Never.
Yes, right. So our judgment is broken. We need to be very careful that we don't impose our sense of right and good on the eternal God who's going to judge all of us. But one day we're going to stand before him, and that brokenness is going to be stripped away. And we'll be able to look at God and look back on all of history and all the decisions he has made, all the judgments he's carried out, and say, wow, God, you are good. And everything that you did was right and good and fair, more so than I ever could have dreamed. That's how we're going to see God, once all of the brokenness is stripped away. So we can rest assured that God will do what is right and good and fair. And if we're thinking, if we're speculating about that person out there, would God send that person to hell? On one hand, that's between them and God. On the other hand, if he does, when we can finally see everything, we're going to go, that was the right thing to do. And we can trust in that. Now, I want to get on to the next question. And that doesn't settle that question. Does anybody feel satisfied about that answer? No? Yes.
That I've heard about that too, that when people ask, if all good people, God would not send them to hell.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, we've got to go and tell people. And actually, I'm going to come back to that at the end of this question. So the next question, and this is the question that we could really spend a few weeks on. Aren't all religions really worshiping the same God? Anybody ever thought that? Wondered that? Anybody ever heard that? Brady's wondered that. Anybody ever heard that? I've heard it, and we hear it expressed in different ways. We'll hear people say, I think God is too big for one religion. boy, I'm trying to resist the urge to go into a bunch of detail here because we're so short on time. But this is a question that we can spend a lot of time chewing on, and we can approach it from several different angles. And first, we can approach it from the biblical angle. What does God's word say about it? And I'm just going to blow through this, and I'll explain why. And I'm not going to read all of these. In your notes are a whole lot of verses, and this just scratches the surface of what God's word has to say about this. Is Christianity, is our God really the only true God? Is Jesus really the only way to be saved? Well, God says in Exodus 20, you've all heard this as part of the Ten Commandments, you shall have what? No other God before me. God says in Exodus 23, do not invoke the names of other gods. Do not let them be heard on your lips. Deuteronomy 6:4, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Deuteronomy 6:14, you shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. Why? Because those other gods aren't me, just from some other angle and some other approach. If they were, God would say, no, they're fine. They're worshiping me too. They just call me by another name and have some different practices. Isaiah 43, God says, I am the Lord. Besides me, there is no Savior. I alone declared, saved, and proclaimed. I am not some foreign God among you. God is being very emphatic that he is God. Those other gods are not God. And I'm going to skip several verses and go to John. Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. And then the verse that PJ referenced earlier, Acts 4:12, there is salvation in no one else. For there is no other name given under heaven, given among men, by which we must be saved. So the Bible is pretty emphatic that there's only one God, and there's only one way to him. And all roads do not lead to salvation and lead to heaven. Now, I'm blowing through the biblical account of this because if you believe that the Bible is authoritative, then that's all you need to hear, right? You know? But the amazing thing about Christianity is that it's not just something that exists in this little book, and if you stay focused on what's here in this book, then it all makes sense, but you get outside of that and it all falls apart. That's not Christianity. We follow a God who made the universe, and his fingerprints are all over. What's the song? His fingerprints are everywhere. The hippo song. Oh, yeah, the hippopotamus song. And our faith will stand up under scrutiny. That's one of the main points of this whole series that we're in right now. We can ask questions, and we may not get all the answers, but our faith can stand up under scrutiny. So what if you don't believe that the Bible is authoritative? Well, we can take several other approaches to this question. Is there really only one God and one way to him? We can take a rational approach. So again, you've heard people say, God is too big for one religion. We're all talking about the same God, just from different approaches. The thing is, if you're saying that about God, where did you get that knowledge? If you're saying of Christians say that their way is the only way. Muslims say that their way is the only way, but they're both wrong because I see God as he really is, and they're really all both talking about the same God, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Jews, whatever else. I have had my eyes open. I know what God is really like. Where did you get that knowledge? A purely speculative approach to God is unwise. We don't approach life in this universe that way, do we? Let me get into what I mean here. We live in a universe that is made up of laws. And those laws are, first of all, they are what they are. They're one way and not another way. And it doesn't matter what we think they are, what we want them to be. It doesn't matter if we don't know about them. They are what they are, right? So work with me here. Those laws also, we are subject to those laws, and those laws cannot be broken. So let's say you have a dream about flying one night, and then you wake up and you're disappointed to find yourself back in the real world where you can't fly because the dream was exhilarating. And you're laying there and you go, you know what? I'm sick of this. I keep having these dreams about flying and they're so great. And I hear all these people telling me about this gravity thing. And I think that they're just imposing that on me to keep me down, both literally and figuratively. And they're trying to box me in and control me and telling me that that way is the only way. Well, you know, that may work for them, but that doesn't work for me. I mean, humanity's wanted to fly for millennia. That desire must be in us because we must be able to fly. So today's the day I'm going to shake off the oppression of gravity, this crazy law. So you climb to the top of the highest building in Houston and you leap off. How's that going to go for you? It's not going to go well.
You're going to fly for a little bit.
You'll reach terminal velocity at some point if the building's tall enough. It's your ideas about gravity and about flight are going to come into very sharp contrast with the law of gravity. And your ideas are going to lose in a very conclusive way, right?
Yes.
We know that it's very unwise to live in the universe based on just our speculation. Go, I think gravity's like this. It's far wiser for us to find what's actually true about the universe, to seek actual knowledge, and then live in cooperation with that, right? But if there's a God, and we're going to now start thinking about a God that we're going to think, okay, maybe this God exists out there. Well, one of the root definitions of God across all religions is that God is powerful, right? And that he has more say over what happens to me than even the laws of the universe do. So why would we speculate about that being and then go on living as though our speculation were right? Because God is whatever God is. God is one way and not another way. When we say, oh, I think God's too big for one religion, it's unwise to go, well, God is eternal and therefore he has no definition. God has definition. God is whatever God is. It doesn't matter what we think God is, doesn't matter what we want God to be like, and it doesn't matter if we're ignorant about what God is like. God is one way and not this way. And if he's powerful, then we are subject to him, right? And God's ways cannot be broken. So it's far wiser for us to seek actual knowledge about God and then live in cooperation with what God is like rather than just go, yeah, I think God is like this. Because if you're wrong, I mean, someday your ideas about God are going to come face to face with the reality of God, right? Here's one way in which Christianity stands apart. Every other belief system, including Christianity, says there's something messed up about this world we live in and about ourselves. And we've all got this sense that the scales are tipped, not in our favor, and that something needs to be put on the other side of that scale to balance things out and make things okay. Every other belief system says, that's up to you. So you better do enough good works, you better chant the right mantras, you better pray the right prayers, perform the right rituals, go to do the right pilgrimages, get the right job, the right salary, the right title, the right spouse, the right collection of influence on Instagram or wherever. And if you do enough, then you'll tip the scales and everything will be okay. Every other belief system says, that's up to you. Christianity alone says, you can't do it. You can do nothing. You can put as much as you want on the other side of that scale and it's not going to budge. Because God is too good and we are too broken. And the distance between us is infinite. So God's over there, we're over here, and we can take trillions of steps towards him and not get a millimeter closer. Christianity says that. You can't do it. But Christianity alone also says, but you don't have to because God did it for you. So to say that that God is really all these other gods too, just from a different angle, those two things are incompatible because other gods say, no, you need to appease me. So when we stand before God, do you want to stand before God hoping that you did enough? Or do you want to stand before him with the confidence that he did it for me because he loves me? So that's the rational approach to that question. That's one of many rational approaches, by the way, to that question. I think the historical approach is really interesting, though. So the historical approach means let's look at the formation of Christianity. So I hope I'm not boring anybody. Hope you're tracking with me because I think this gets really cool. Let me set the stage for the time during which Christianity formed, which is roughly the year 30, 40, 50 AD, somewhere in there. What was the world like? We had the Jewish people. And the Jewish people had their scriptures, which is what we call the Old Testament. And their scriptures were full of prophecies about a king who was going to come someday from among their own people and set up a kingdom that was going to be both global and eternal. Everybody was going to be subject to its rule, and once he sets this kingdom up, it's going to last forever. And when you read the descriptions of that kingdom, it was going to be glorious. It was going to be a great thing. So their scriptures were full of that, and their scriptures were written over a span of at least 1,000 years. So you have all of these people writing, saying there's something coming, there's a king coming. who's going to set you free, and he's going to set up this awesome kingdom, global and eternal kingdom. So they're looking for this king. So that's ingredient number one. Ingredient number two is what people believed about the afterlife, specifically what they believed about physical resurrection at that time. And when you look at the world at that time, you find that there are two major beliefs. There are a bunch of people who didn't believe in any spiritual afterlife whatsoever. There's no spiritual realm. Once you die, that's it. There are a bunch of other people who believe that there is an afterlife, but it's spiritual only. That included the Roman religions, the Greek religions, and even a bunch of the Jews who believed that the physical is inferior to the spiritual. So once you die, you shed this inferior physical form and you go on to a higher existence, and your eternal afterlife is spiritual only. You did have one group within the Jews, the Pharisees. Y'all heard of them? The Sadducees. You heard of the Sadducees? So they didn't believe in a physical afterlife, and that's why they were so sad, you see. Anyway, that's a lame thing that I heard somewhere, and that'll help you remember. Sorry about that.
It is.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so the Pharisees, though, they... was
sheep song.
Was that them? Oh, okay. All right. That was weird. The Pharisees did believe in a physical afterlife, but physical afterlife, physical resurrection was coming at the end of time for everybody who was getting saved all at once. Nobody gets resurrected early. So apart from them, everybody believed in no afterlife or spiritual afterlife only. So those are the two ingredients, what people believed about physical resurrection, and you've got the Jewish people waiting for their king of prophecy. That's the environment in which Christianity formed, and it formed very suddenly. And it exploded on the scene, and it spread like wildfire. And these Christians had some interesting characteristics. This movement had some interesting characteristics. First of all, they all unanimously believed that Jesus had been physically resurrected. And anybody who puts their trust in him will also be physically resurrected. So you've got this mass shift in belief, because the people who were Christians would have been something else before that. So they're all going, okay, yeah, I used to believe in no afterlife whatsoever, or I used to believe in only a spiritual afterlife, but I've changed my mind now. Now I believe that this guy physically came back to life, and so am I. So you've got a mass shift in belief. They also believe that Jesus was the king prophesied about in all these books of the Old Testament. They unanimously believed that. And they refused to turn to the polytheistic religion of Rome. See, as Rome would expand and as they conquered new civilizations, they would absorb the religions of those civilizations, and they would absorb their gods. So their system was ever growing, adding new gods. And when you become a Roman subject, they would say to you, okay, now you've got to renounce your exclusive religion. You've got to worship all these gods. That's why we have a scene in Acts where Paul is staying at a place called the Areopagus, and he's surrounded by all of these monuments to all of these gods, because that's what Rome was doing. And Rome would say, now you've got to worship all of these gods. Well, these Christians weren't having it. They were saying, no, there's not many gods. There's one God, and that's all we're going to worship, and Jesus is the only way to him. And there are all these letters. You can, again, all of this is just history. I'm not even appealing to the Bible for this. You can read these letters that were written between Roman officials where they're saying, what are we going to do with these Christians? They're so obstinate and stubborn. They refuse to turn to the true religion, the Roman religion. And there's one guy who's writing, well, you know, I went to them and I asked them once nicely. I asked them a second time nicely. The third time I had to get threatening. And the fourth time I had to order their execution. Christians are being thrown to the lions and executed in horrible ways. So Christianity is spreading in the face of very violent opposition. That's another trait. And the last thing is that as Rome came to power, there were lots of rebellions that rose up, little skirmishes, people who didn't like the new big, you know, the kid on the block. And so they were going, no, we're not going to follow your rule. Well, Rome was big and powerful, and so they had a very efficient way of shutting all those movements down. And they would do so by killing the leader. And in all those other movements, the movement dies out with the leader, except Christianity, which spreads like crazy. So when we look at it from a historical perspective for these Christians and how Christianity formed, we've got some really challenging questions to answer, some things that don't make sense if Jesus stayed dead. From a historical standpoint, it's really hard to explain all of these things if Jesus stayed dead. I mean, if he stayed dead, why would all these people be shifting their beliefs about him? And by the way, it would have been very easy to debunk. Jesus' resurrection would have been easy to debunk. All you do is produce the body. They knew where he was buried. The Pharisees were trying to shut down these rumors of resurrection. The Romans were. They could have said, here's the body. Would have been real easy. And by the way, they had a system of fact-checking built into their culture. They didn't have Google. They had built into their culture this system of word of mouth and eyewitness. And so Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, after Jesus rose, he appeared first to Peter, and then he appeared to the rest of the 12 disciples, and then he appeared to about 500 people all at once. And then Paul says, and most of those people are still alive. He's saying that to these people in Corinthians that he's writing to. He's appealing to this fact-checking system they had. He's saying, go to Jerusalem, talk to these people. And it wasn't just one or two people in isolation, one guy walking through the woods, and he thought he saw Jesus walking between two trees, and he came back, and another guy was like, yeah, I was kind of half asleep, and I thought I saw him standing in my room. And it wasn't like that at all. It was 500 people, and they're all standing there going, there he is. Do you see him? Yeah, I see him. He's standing right there. Bunches of eyewitnesses. Paul is saying, go talk to them. And they could have talked to them and debunked the whole thing. So in light of all of this, how do we explain so many people, if Jesus stayed dead, how do we explain so many people shifting their belief about afterlife and saying, no, now I believe in a physical afterlife? How do we explain people saying he's the king that was prophesied about? Because if he's dead, how can he be king? Why are people willing to face violent opposition and not turn to the religion of Rome if they weren't certain that he had actually come back to life? And why did the movement persist after they killed him when all the other movements died with the leaders? It makes sense to say that something happened, something monumental happened. So how does this fit in with our question today? The Old Testament, all along, was for 1,000 years, at least 1,000 years, the Old Testament spans 1,000 years, lots of different people writing, claiming to speak on behalf of God. And over and over and over again, it's pointing forward to the death and resurrection of Jesus, but not in a way that people saw coming. How many of you have seen The Sixth Sense or Arlington Road? You know those movies that have the crazy plot twist at the end? The plot twist gets there and everybody gasps in amazement because for two reasons. On one hand, they didn't see the plot twist coming. It was unexpected. But there, on the other hand, the movie goes back and shows you, no, we were setting this up all along. And everybody sees it. And then when you go back and watch the movie the second time, you're going, oh yeah, I totally see how they were setting this up. Right? Have you seen those movies?
Yeah.
That's exactly what's going on here. The Old Testament, which spans a really, really long period of time, lots of different people saying lots of things over and over and over again that were fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus, as though there were an author with a capital A writing the story. And these authors, as they're speaking about the death and resurrection, this coming king, this servant king, this suffering servant who's going to deliver people from slavery and set up a global kingdom, and the whole world's going to be blessed. As these guys are talking about this, the Old Testament is talking to us about the nature of reality. It's making some very big claims. It's claiming to tell us how the universe got here in the first place and why the universe is the way that it is, both the good and the bad. The Old Testament claims to tell us why we are the way we are, both the good and the bad. The Old Testament claims to tell us about the nature of God himself, who God is, what he's like, and the nature of our relationship with him and our need for him. And if as these people are talking about all of these big picture things, first of all, this is not a God that's just exclusive to one culture. They're saying this is the God who made everything. And if they're saying all of these things about this God, and they're pointing forward to this monumental event, which is then fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus, then it's all true. And there's nothing more valuable, more worthwhile for us to center our lives around. It doesn't make sense for us, in light of all that, to look at all that and go, yeah, you know, that works for you, but that doesn't work for me. I'm going to go find my own truth over here. That's the most irrational thing to do. If we're really seeing this, So what are the implications for Community of Hope in this question? Because I don't know, maybe there's not many of us here who are going, you know, my neighbor over there who doesn't know Jesus, I think he's going to be fine. I think that neighbor, his road leads to heaven too. I'm not going to go tell him about Jesus. I don't really need to. I don't know that there's anybody really thinking that. And I don't know that there's anybody that's sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'm calling on Jesus, but I'm also going to do these other things too to make it okay and to balance the scales out. Nobody's really thinking that. But when we don't tell our neighbor or a coworker or a family member or a friend who doesn't know about Jesus, when we don't tell them about Jesus, aren't we living like we believe that? And when we go and we pursue other things and we don't put God first and say, God, you alone are the source of my being. You alone are the source of my satisfaction, my joy. You are the only thing that can put me back together and balance the scales. And I really believe that you did it so that I don't have to. And we live for other things as well as God, but we go, you know what, I'm going to make sure I add a little bit of God to my life, just make sure everything's okay here, but for the most part, I'm living for this other stuff. Aren't we really living like Jesus isn't the only way? Like, we're going to do some things to balance the scales, to be our own God. That's the implication here. So I don't know that anybody would actually say, no, all roads lead to heaven, but we often live that way, don't we? So, what if next year, 2020, could that be the year that we as a church and as individuals get over the fear of telling people about Jesus and actually go and tell people about Jesus and not just do nice things? We need to do nice things for people, right? We've got to bring joy and beauty. So it was really good at the up. Remember the up, in, and out? And how in? This sense of community at this church is awesome. I left the Advent service at the Mouchards home this past week thinking, man, I love this church. And I don't know that I ever really thought that about any other church. I mean, it's not that I disliked the other churches that I worked for, but I don't recall ever walking away from something going, man, I love these people. I love this church. I love this church. We've got great sense of community and we're good at seeking God together. But where we're weakest and where I'm weakest is in the out, is in telling people who don't know about Jesus, telling them about Jesus. And acting like we really do believe, first of all, that we love our neighbor, and so we want what's best for them, and we want them to be restored, and Jesus is the only way. And we don't act like we love God, and we're not okay when people are pursuing other gods, either, you know, gods that they're calling on by name, or material gods, or whatever. We're not okay when they're giving those other gods glory, when only our God deserves it. So can we, in 2020... change the way that we behave in regards to telling people about Jesus and live like this is all really true? That is one of my personal challenges for myself, is to get over that fear. Now, that doesn't mean that every conversation we go, no, okay, be quiet, I just need to tell you about Jesus. You know, we pursue relationship with them and we demonstrate to them what the love of God looks like. But we also don't go, man, I'm glad I don't have to say anything. How will they call upon him of whom they have not heard? And how will they hear unless we tell them? And isn't he worthy of us telling them? Isn't he worthy? If he's worthy of our worship, then isn't he also worthy of their worship? And isn't that really the best thing for us and for them and for the whole world? Isn't that what we're celebrating this season? So let's actually act on that next year. And I want to pray. And don't hear this prayer and go, okay, now we're done. Now we're going to get on with our day. I want to ask you to be chewing on all this and go, you know, what does my life show that I believe about God and the way to pursue him and how God is found and how the scales are balanced and how things are made okay? And be willing to talk about it as you sit down to lunch and challenge each other and pray for each other so that we can live what we say we believe.